This is case number 70586, State Local Government Employees Management Relations versus the Educational Support Employees Association. The argument is 30 minutes, 15 minutes on each side. Would the appellant like to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor. 2 minutes, please.
Okay. I usually watch the clock, and sometimes they're able to actually save their 2 minutes, and sometimes they're not. So we'll see how they do.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bordelove.
Donald Bordelove on behalf of the EMRB. May it please the court. I want to begin with the single most important point of this case. The parties take the court down a lot of different avenues of analysis in the briefs, but the takeaway is that no matter what avenue of analysis this court goes down, the normal, universally used, standard majority of the votes, whoever gets the most votes win, applies. Now, what I mean by this, for example, is the parties have briefed in detail the standard review, and we go down different avenues of analysis here. And whether it's a de novo review as ESEA advances or one of deference as the board advances, the same result occurs, which originate from the statute itself, the subject statute in dispute. NRS 288.160 subsection 4 provides, if the board in good faith doubts whether any employee organization is supported by a majority of the local government employees in a particular bargaining unit, it may conduct an election by secret ballot upon the question. Looking at the statute itself, even if we didn't give the board any deference, which wouldn't be correct, the statute at a minimum is ambiguous. There's two ways that a statute may be ambiguous. Either it's capable of two or more reasonable interpretations, or it may be one that does not otherwise speak to the issue before the court. And it's ambiguous because, similar to the NLRA, which our statute is modeled after, our enabling statute, doesn't explicitly provide for the standards to determine the results of an election. The statute instead simply provides that the board may conduct an election if it has a good faith doubt as to majority support. The board in 2003 that actually first created the supermajority rule in the first place noted this as well, specifically stating, quote, the legislature does not appear to have specifically addressed whether the majority is of votes cast or of members in the bargaining unit and NRS 288.60 subsection 4. As the court knows, if the statute is ambiguous, we look to legislative history, intent, similar statutory schemes, and the act as a whole to determine what the framers intended. Now, again, here the court can go down different avenues of analysis, both of which lead to the same result.
What's ambiguous about your NAC, about 288.110, section 10, subsection D? The election demonstrates the employee organization is supported by a majority of the employees within the particular bargaining unit. So what is ambiguous about that?
I don't think the statute is what is ambiguous. The regulation is not ambiguous. The regulation, if going towards the plain meaning, using the plain meaning of the regulation, the operative word demonstrate, if you go to the plain meaning of the word demonstrate, it shows, which means to show by way of an example.
Yeah. And so the board the election demonstrates.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Correct, Your Honor.
So why is that? So you think 288, NRS 288 is ambiguous, but not NAC 288.110?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So what is ambiguous? We'll strike that. Section 4 of .160 is the standard to call an election, right? I mean, that's what they're talking about. If the board in good faith doubts.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So what? How are these not in harmony?
They are in harmony, Your Honor. The statute is ambiguous because it doesn't explicitly provide what the standard is to conduct election. The statute's function is to authorize the board to conduct an election, and the regulation's function is to set the standard.
And so you set a standard?
Correct, Your Honor.
How can you just change it?
The board, since its inception in 1969, mm-hmm. actually used the majority of the vote standard mm-hmm. with success. That's what's an original interpretation. In 2003, the board arbitrarily announced the supermajority rule. The board considered no objective evidence.
But 288.110 is a supermajority rule, so it's not arbitrary. That recalls for a supermajority. Is that right? By its plain words.
The statute or the regulation?
The regulation calls for a supermajority. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. I disagree. I think according to the plain language of the regulation, using the operative word demonstrate, the plain language to show by way of an example. And at the very least, if somehow this court thinks the regulation is ambiguous, this court holds that similar to statutory construction, we look to legislative history or, in this case, administrative history and the like. And when the regulation was enacted, the board used the majority of the votes cast standard. And it used it for over 30 years with success. In 2003 is when the board changed course. And if you look at their order, it's a single-page order. It doesn't discuss any evidence. No elections had occurred. And it actually based it on a cursory and incomplete reading of the regulation. It leaves out the entire language of the regulation if you look to the order. It actually leaves out the word demonstrate. It also ignores the NLRA, which we are based off of. It ignores governing election standards.
But you're ignoring the word election in that section. It says the election demonstrates. It's not just it's demonstrated. It says the election demonstrates that a majority of the employees within the particular bargaining unit. So why isn't looking at the amount of people in the bargaining unit when it's determining whether or not you've reached your threshold? Why isn't that what demonstrates?
Well, I think it's the election itself that demonstrates.
Right.
And as this court has stated time and again, as long as the board's construction of its own regulation is within the language, it's entitled to great deference. And the board looked at its regulation along with governing election standards, the NLRA, which we are based off of, and the legislative history and intent. And based on all those things, it determined that the majority of the votes cast standard is what applies. Now, if we look to the legislative history and the like, it informs us that the majority of the votes cast standard is what applies. There's nothing in the legislative history, similar statutory schemes, or the Act as a whole that points to the supermajority standard.
You've agreed both statutes are not ambiguous, right?
Can you repeat that?
You agreed 288.160 is not ambiguous.
I think the statute, NRS 288.160 subsection 4, is ambiguous.
Is ambiguous.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, as this court stated, there's two ways a statute may be ambiguous. Either it's capable of two or more reasonable interpretations, or it may not be one that doesn't otherwise speak to the issue before the court. And in this case, it's something, and as this court states, when our language of statute is plain and unambiguous is a strong word, its meaning is clear and unmistakable. There's no room for construction. Then we apply the plain meaning. But if not, then we look to the legislative history, intent, similar statutory schemes, and the Act as a whole to determine what the framers intended. And if we look at those points, they all point to the majority of the vote standard. Or, instead of going the legislative history route, this court can also look to the statute, which grants the board specific rulemaking authority in this area, precisely to the issue. Specifically, NRS 288.110 provides that the board may make rules governing the recognition of employer organizations. And if we look to that, and that's what the board did here, codified its standard in this regulation. And again, the regulation specifically provides an employee organization will be considered the exclusive bargaining agent for employees within a bargaining unit pursuant to an election if the election demonstrates that the employee organization is supported by a majority of employees within a particular bargaining unit. And so if you look at the statute, which grants the board specific rulemaking authority in this area, the recognition of employee organization, the board may make rules governing thereto. The regulation has the force of law, as it was properly adopted. That hasn't been challenged on appeal. And as mentioned, as this court has stated time and again, as long as the board's interpretation of its own regulation is within the language, it's entitled great deference. The board's interpretation is within the regulation because of the operative word demonstrate. I don't think there's a reasonable argument that can be made that the board's construction of its own regulation is, quote, plainly erroneous.
Well, how do we deal with the fact then that this court two times has said that you essentially need a supermajority in this same case? How do we do that?
Excellent question, Your Honor. And I think there was a fair amount of discuss there. If you look at the 2005 order in its entirety, you can see that it's actually a deferential standard that was applied to the board. And then the court was presented with the board's decision, and then when it went off what it has. Tellingly, based on this court's 2013 order in the related cases, such pre-election review shouldn't even have occurred. As the court held in 2013, courts lack the jurisdiction to conduct a pre-election review of the board's chosen election procedure.
So you're not asking us to overrule anything in the past that this court has accomplished?
No, Your Honor. I think the board's order is consistent with the prior orders. To the extent that the court disagrees, I think it should overrule those prior orders and take a fresh look. And there's ample authority to do so, either because the 2005 order is void, it's dicta, or exceptions to the law of the case doctrine apply.
Why would we give deference to an interpretation of a plain and clear statement that's at odds? And you say in Section D of the NAC, supported by a majority of the employees within the particular bargaining unit. It's your regulation. That regulation could have been written to just say a simple majority of those who vote, but it didn't. It said a majority of the employees within the particular bargaining unit. And to interpret contrary to that, why isn't that an absurd interpretation?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor. And I think the reason the regulation doesn't state that explicitly is because no one thought that a supermajority rule would ever apply.
Well, it's since 2003 you have. So we're 15 years now.
And in 2003, the board arbitrarily announced that rule. It ignored the standards it had used to conduct elections for over 30 years. It ignored NLRA precedent. It ignored governing election standards. It ignored everything that everybody does. And instead, it said the statute was ambiguous, doesn't provide for it in 2003, and then it went to the regulation and said, this is what the regulation provides, but it doesn't quote the entire regulation. And so now what's different here today is in the past is twofold. One, we actually have the results of the election. Each election producing progressively more definitive results demonstrating majority support in favor of Local 14. In fact, in the last election, Local 14 received 82% of the vote to ESEA's 18%. 82% to 18%. And that's what ESEA is asking this court to do. Keep it in power and maintain the status quo, even though it received just 18% to Local 42's 82%. And the second thing that's different is the court is presented with an entirely new agency decision with the facts, evidence, and analysis to recommend it. I want to mention that there's actually, going along that line, there's actually an omission in the legislative history that's actually quite significant in this case. And that's because the supermajority rule is unheard of. It's an aberration from labor standards. Labor standards that our legislature explicitly modeled in its enactment of NRS Chapter 288. And the lack of any legislative reference whatsoever to such an abnormality suggests that wasn't the true intent. Put it another way, if the intent was to adopt such a departure from what is universally used, we'd expect there to at least be some mention of it. Since there isn't, we may logically infer either that the simple majority use was the intended standard because of the prevalence, and conversely the lack of any use of the supermajority standard, or the adoption was left to the board because of its specialized skills.
Okay, so it was left to the board. So 288.160 subsection 4 was silent on how to count votes, whether to have a simple majority of the votes cast or whether or not to apply supermajority.
Correct, Your Honor.
The NAC, so the board's position was that it should be a supermajority. That's what's written in here.
In their 2003 order, Your Honor?
Not in the order, in the NAC. So, yes, in the 2003.
Right.
That's what we're applying.
Right, and so the board in 2003 got it wrong for all of those reasons
but,
I mentioned.
But you haven't changed the NAC. How do you interpret an unambiguous section differently without going through the procedures, the APA procedures, to either change the NAC, or because it seems very clear on its face that it requires a supermajority.
That's an excellent question, Your Honor. And as this court holds, we do not require an agency to use the formal rulemaking process when correcting a policy that is based on erroneous interpretation. Quote, we reason that requiring administrative agencies to comply with the formal rulemaking requirements of the APA would lock an agency into an erroneous interpretation of its regulation and its governing statutes. Quote, an administrative agency is not disqualified from changing its mind, and when it does, the court should not approve the statutory construction issued de novo and without regard to the administrative understanding of the statutes. The agency only needs to consider a well-considered basis for the change, and that board has provided more than a well-considered basis for the change. Six bases. One, the substantial evidence before it, the outcomes of the elections, with each election producing progressively more definitive results. Two, prevailing labor law and election standards. Three, proper regulatory interpretation. Four, the board's historical application of most votes standard, including its application at the time of the regulation's enactment. Five, the absence of any objective evidence whatsoever to support the supermajority standard. And six, the election's results themselves, which rendered that our statute is rendered meaningless, or at least produces an unjust result if construed to require such an aberration, such an abnormality. Here, the elections undeniably demonstrate that Local 14 is supported by a majority of the bargaining unit. While it's not a mathematical certainty, the results of the election established a high probability, in fact, a near certainty, that Local 14 is represented by a majority of the bargaining unit. Again, in the last election, Local 14 received 82% of the vote to ESEA's 18%.
You have about a half a minute left. Do you want to reserve some time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I would like to reserve the remainder.
I'll give you your 2 minutes, and I'll give Mr. Flaherty an extra minute, 16 minutes. You don't have to use it up, Mr. Flaherty, but if you need it, use it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So we'll have the 2 minutes in rebuttal, and you'll have 16 minutes.
And Mr. Flaherty, in addition to whatever arguments you've already got prepared, can you just address the differences between the NLRA and our own statutory scheme?
Yes, I'd be happy to, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. Frank Flaherty on behalf of Respondent ESCA. On the one hand, this case is simple. It's about correcting an agency's plain legal error. On the other hand, it's sort of more profound in that it actually presents a challenge to the separation of powers established in the Nevada Constitution. We have a situation here where, in constitutional terms, the legislative branch has enacted a statute, NRS 288-160, specifically subsection 4. The judicial branch, in its constitutional capacity, has interpreted that statute twice and made a finding that was binding on the agency and the parties in this matter. Yet the executive branch, specifically the administrative agency here, feels that it has the authority to disregard the directives of the judicial branch and essentially rewrite the statute. The substantial disagreement regarding the issues, but really the overarching issue here, is did the board violate NRS 288-160 subsection 4? NRS 288-160 was established by the legislature and sets forth a comprehensive scheme for obtaining recognition as the exclusive bargaining agent for a unit of local government employees and for losing recognition or being displaced. Subsections 1 and 2 address a situation where a union approaches a government employer and says, we want to represent this unit. One of the things the union has to do, if they're going to be voluntarily recognized, is present the employer with a verified membership list showing that it represents a majority of the employees in the entire bargaining unit. They can't come with a list and say, we asked 1,000 people, 501 joined, here's their names. Okay, that's not the way it works. It's got to be a majority of the entire bargaining unit. Subsection 3 talks about the situation where a local government employer can ask the board's permission to withdraw recognition from a union it's already recognized. And one of the bases is the union's ceased to be supported by a majority of employees in the entire bargaining unit. Subsection 4 is the election subsection. And that provides that whenever the board has a good faith doubt regarding whether any employee organization is supported by a majority of the employees in the bargaining unit, it may conduct an election. Now, I emphasize the word may because that is the word in the statute. It doesn't say shall. So it's up to the board. The board has discretion. It does not have to order an election in the first instance. Now, that could be a situation like we have here, where we have a recognized incumbent and a challenger seeking to displace it. It could be a situation where two unions have approached an employer to represent the same unit that currently doesn't have an agent. Okay, or it could be a situation where the employer is seeking to withdraw recognition and the board has decided it's going to have an election. Okay. But the one common thing on all of those elections is to either gain recognition or to displace the bargaining agent who's already been recognized. You've got to have the affirmative vote of a majority of the entire bargaining unit. Subsection 5 talks about the fact that
I want to back up. On subsection 4, it doesn't say how we're supposed to count votes. It says how the board, what the board is to consider in determining whether or not to have a special election or whether or not they may invoke their power to have an election. So 4 doesn't particularly necessarily inform us just in the plain language how to count the votes. Do you agree with that?
I would agree with that, but then you look at the statutory scheme. I mean, we've already established that to obtain recognition in the first instance, okay, you've got to have a majority of the entire bargaining unit, okay? And we know the overarching theme of NRS Chapter 288 is labor stability. 288-150 sets forth mandatory subjects of bargaining. Starting around NRS 288-200, there's a dispute resolution mechanism involved when the parties reach impasse at bargaining, and there's arbitration. And, of course, strikes are outlawed. And in fact, striking is a crime in Nevada. So the one clear theme in NRS Chapter 288 is labor stability. And in fact, in 1975, the Nevada Supreme Court said that labor peace and stability in Nevada's public schools is a compelling public interest. So that's the one clear directive that the EMRB has, labor stability. And let's get to the difference now between the NLRA and NRS 288-160. Oh, to finish that point, it wouldn't make a lot of sense to require someone to obtain recognition from the entire bargaining unit, from a majority of the entire bargaining unit, but then a challenger can come along, or the employer can come along, and say, okay, well, it's just a majority of the votes cast. I mean, what if 100 people had voted in the election, and it was a 51-49 vote?
Well, to get that election, you'd still have to have demonstrated a majority of the bargaining unit. Or you had, I'm sorry.
If I can, Your Honor, the board has to have a good faith
doubt. Right, a good faith doubt as to whether they have that.
And ESEA lost that argument in 2005. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, I think the lesson for the board here is if we're going to have an election, we need a good faith doubt that 50% plus one doesn't support the current bargaining agent. That 50% plus one are going to turn out and vote to have no union or to replace the union with a different union. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to require that high bar at the beginning, and then you can just start churning through not having a union or changing unions just based on the majority of the votes cast. That's not labor stability. And so now getting to the difference between this statute and the NLRA, realize that this is different from a political election here in Nevada. Okay, we all have a right to vote. It's a constitutional right to vote. The only reason the support staff employees of the Clark County School District have a right to vote is because the legislature in 1969 said, we're going to have public sector collective bargaining for local government employees. So the right to vote is a legislative right to vote. And when the legislature imposes that system, in other words, when the legislature grants that right, it is within the legislature's right to say, these are going to be the conditions. If we're going to have public sector unions in Nevada, they have to have a majority of the entire bargaining unit before they're going to be recognized. Okay? And that's the difference with the NLRA. With the NLRA, it doesn't require a majority of the bargaining unit to win an election. But the Supreme Court specifically addressed this because Local 14 argued to the court in 2005. It argued about the NLRA. And the court said, no, the plain and unambiguous language of NRS 288-160 subsection 4 is different than the NLRA, and it doesn't apply. So political elections aren't applicable, and elections under the NLRA or under other states' public sector collective bargaining laws, they're simply not germane here. So returning to the Nevada Constitution, the role of the judiciary, here briefly twice is what the Supreme Court said about this section of the statute. In its 2005 order of affirmance under a heading, plain and unambiguous, the court said, referring to NRS 288-160 subsection 4 and NAC 288-110-10D, the court said this, the statute and administrative code plainly and unambiguously state that to win an election, the employer organization must have a majority of the employees within the particular bargaining unit. And the court went on to add that because this was the case of an unambiguous statute, the EMRB was required to follow the law regardless of result. And then the court said, we defer to the Nevada legislature as to whether the definition of majority vote should be changed. So as early as 2005, the Supreme Court rejected Local 14's argument and the board's argument that what they refer to as the supermajority is somehow an unworkable standard. I'd have to note that in the last election, Local 14 came within 1,441 votes of satisfying the legislatively dictated standard of majority of the bargaining unit. So it's not an unworkable standard. It's been working, as far as we know, ever since the Act's founding in 1969, but it's just, in this one case, the board is apparently unhappy with the result. In 2009, the Supreme Court reaffirmed this position regarding this issue in the context of the runoff election. And the court said this, the language of NRS 288-160 and NAC 288-110 are plain and unambiguous and require an employee organization to obtain support from a majority of all the members of the bargaining unit and not just a majority of those who vote. And the court also concluded that NRS 288-160 sub 4's majority of the entire unit standard was equally applicable in the runoff election
And again, the court foreclosed or cut off this argument about this being unworkable when it said, we realize this may lead to an inconclusive result. Now, the MRB has argued that the court's plain guidance isn't controlling because its review was not de novo in 2005 or 2009. But that's not what happened. The Supreme Court didn't look at 288.160 subsection 4 and determine that it had more than one possible meaning and then say, hey, the board's interpretation is consistent. Rather, in 2005, the court stated, in light of this plain and unambiguous language, referring to NRS 288.160 subsection 4, we will not disturb the EMRB's interpretation. So those few words are very important. When this court looks at a statute and says the language is plain and unambiguous, that is a de novo review. It's only after the court says that that it says we're going to defer the EMRB's interpretation. And also remember that in 2003, the EMRB looked at NRS 288.160 subsection 4 and they scratch their head and say, hey, there's no answer there. There's no guidance from the statute. But when the Supreme Court looked at it in 2005, it didn't go along with that. It looked at that same statute and said the language is plain and unambiguous and it requires the vote of a majority of the entire bargaining unit. So clearly, the court's review in 2005 was de novo. Now, the board's latched on to a statement at the beginning of the Supreme Court's 2005 order that reads as follows. Review is limited to determining whether there was substantial evidence in the record to support the agency determination or statutory interpretation. Now, that was near the beginning of the opinion where the court customarily recites the standard of review, and there's several sentences, and then there's footnotes appended. And footnote 9 was appended to that sentence. And footnote 9 cited to Sis versus Christensen and State Division of Insurance versus State Farm. Now, the Christensen case was a substantial evidence case. There wasn't any question of law really before the court in that case. It was about whether or not a worker's exposure to asbestos had aggravated the respiratory condition. It was, and the court found there was substantial evidence supporting the agency's finding in that regard. So in footnote 9, it's the citation to State Farm that the court was relying on regarding statutory interpretation. And State Farm is very clear. It says that when statutory interpretation is involved, a court will only defer if the agency's interpretation is consistent and within the language of the statute. And then, quoting, it said, court will not hesitate to declare a regulation invalid when the regulation conflicts with existing statutory provisions or exceeds the statutory authority of the agency. The Supreme Court's order in 2005 didn't simply defer to the MRB's decision. It said the EMRB was required to, it interpreted it de novo, and said the EMRB is required to follow the law regardless of result. Because the Supreme Court's orders interpreted 288.160 subsection 4 and the regulation 288.110.10d de novo and declared that they both plainly and unambiguously required majority support to be determined by a majority of all of the employees in the unit, any prerogative the board had to change its mind or to engage in an evolutional approach, or to experiment, those were all foreclosed after 2005. The board didn't own that regulation. It didn't own that interpretation. The judicial branch owned it at that point. And the only way the board can change it at that point was either to come back here, or really what the board had to do is it had to go to the Nevada legislature, because that's what this court said in 2005. You were going to defer to the Nevada legislature to change the standard. Now, the board cited some cases that stand for the general rule that a court gives deference to rulings of an administrative agency that is supported by substantial evidence and the conclusions of law when closely related to the agency's view of the facts are entitled to deference. The cases the board cited, however, are distinguishable because the issue on appeal in those cases was the appropriateness of the particular agency's conclusions of law when applied to the facts. The issue on appeal in this case is whether the board had the authority to interpret NRS 288.160 subsection 4 and create a new rule that conflicts with the plain language of the statute. And clearly the board doesn't have the authority to do that. And Justice Stiglitz, you asked a question about the Administrative Procedure Act. The board also violated that here, because even though it was in the context of a single case, what the board effectively did is it announced that when we have a situation where a majority of the bargaining unit doesn't vote for either union
in either the runoff, the election, or the runoff election. In our discretion, we may or may not order a second discretionary runoff election where we get to deviate from the legislatively dictated standard. Now, I think the reason the board hasn't engaged in rulemaking on that is because it's never going to make it past LCB in light of the Supreme Court's decision in 2005, 2009, and in fact, in light of the plain language of the statute. Now, the board's argued that the 2005 and 2009 decisions aren't controlling here. Well, they're certainly not dicta, and they certainly are the law of the case. In fact, citing Supreme Court Rule 123, in May of 2015, the board successfully argued to the district court that the Supreme Court's third decision in this case, from December of 2013, was the law of the case, and it got relief from the district court on that basis. And also, Local 14 presented the issue squarely to the Nevada Supreme Court in 2005. And this is what the Supreme Court had to say. Local 14 argues the EMRB erred in interpreting NRS 288-160 and NAC 288-10-110 as stating a majority status election is won by a majority of all members in the bargaining unit instead of a majority of members who vote. We disagree. And a few pages later, I'm running out of time, but I'll give you an extra minute. Oh, it was already on there, Your Honor. Thank you. The court said, again, the statute and administrative code plainly and unambiguously state that to win an election, the employee organization must have a majority of the employees within a particular bargaining. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flaherty. Rebuttal?
Thank you.
Mr. Bordelov? 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'll begin with, as Justice Stiglitz asked, about the difference between our statute, the NLRA, and the EMRA. I'd like to first quote the Nevada Supreme Court. Quote, when a federal statute is adopted in a statute of this state, a presumption arises that the legislature knew and intended to adopt the construction placed on the federal statute by federal courts. This rule of statutory construction is applicable, however, only if the state and federal acts are substantially similar and the statute does not reflect a contrary intent. Our statutes are substantially similar. And I'll quote the NLRA, which specifically states, Section 9, representatives designated or selected for purposes of collective bargaining by a majority of the employees in the unit shall be the exclusive representative. Whenever a petition shall have been filed, the board shall investigate such petition, and if it has reasonable cause to believe that a question of representation exists, shall provide for the appropriate hearing upon due notice. If the board finds upon the record that such a question of representation exists, it shall direct an election by secret ballot and shall certify the results. NRS 288.160 subsection 4, if the board in good faith doubts whether any employee organization is supported by a majority of employees in a unit, it may conduct an election by secret ballot upon the question. And so our statute is substantially similar to the NLRA, and indeed the same procedure provides. A petition is filed if there's a good faith doubt or under the NLRA, reasonable cause to believe, they order a hearing to see if election is justified because elections are expensive and the board pays for them. If it determines an election is justified, it goes ahead and orders the election. And it has in the NRA the same language, majority of the whole bargaining unit. And pursuant to the NLRA, the federal courts have uniformly held that the appropriate standards for such elections, the majority of the votes cast, explaining such things as it has been repeatedly held under recognized rules attending elections that those not in the election must be presumed to assent to the express will of the majority. Importantly, the NLRA has held, the NLRB has held, quote, we have determined that election results should be certified where all eligible voters have an adequate opportunity to participate in the election, notwithstanding low voter participation. The fundamental purpose of board election is to provide employees with a meaningful opportunity to express their sentiments concerning representation for the purposes of collective bargaining. The law does not compel any employee to vote, and the law should not permit to refrain from voting to defeat an otherwise valid election.
Your time's up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Court, thanks both counsel for your excellent arguments in this case and the briefs that you prepared. This